Good evening. Please be turning to Ezra chapter 8. Ezra 8. It is my ambitious goal to get through the rest of Ezra tonight. We'll see if that is a realized goal at the end of the class. Ezra 8. So let's just refresh our memories, refresh our minds on what's going on in the text, the context here. Starting in Ezra 7, this begins the era of Ezra himself and how he comes to Jerusalem from Persia. And he brings with him a group of people that, if you do the math of the numbers given in chapter 8, then it comes to about 1,700 men that are counted. And if you add in estimate of women and children, most people are going to tell you probably somewhere around 5,000 people. So not a huge number. Zerubbabel, 80 years earlier, brought with him about 50,000 people. And this is only about 5,000. What is the main makeup of the type of people that come back, though, as far as tribes and duties and so forth? Are they just anybody and everybody? What is the main group of people? Say it again. Okay, you got a bunch of priests. You've got those who are connected to the worship at the temple. And that's important because part of Ezra's job, why he was coming back, was to teach the statutes of the law and to restore the worship and the beautification of the temple and things of that nature. So that's his mission. And so he's going to bring with him, of course, people that are going to help in that regard. Yeah, all of those people would be from the tribe of Levi. Now, that's not to say that all the people that came back, that there's just Levites, but it seems like a good portion, at least, of the ones that do come back are connected to that service. And we've talked about this word before several classes ago, but the Nethinim is mentioned. At least that's the way the New King James translates it. It's actually, they leave it untranslated. That would be the Hebrew word for it, Nethinim. And there's speculation as to who those people are, but most likely that's going all the way back to Joshua when he conquered the land, and those people from, help me out here, the name of the town that was close by and they pretended like they were so far away, starts with a G. Gibeon. Isn't that right? Gibeon or Gibeon? The Gibeonites? Boy, I'm drawn. Things are getting all mixed up in my brain tonight. You got the character Gideon, and then you know the judge Gideon, and then you've got where these people are from. I think it was Gibeon, but in any case, they were made slaves, and so the theory is that this is their descendants. They remain slaves, all of them, through their lineage to work with the people there in the temple. And they're mentioned as well. So let's take a look at chapter 8. And remember two weeks ago I said that chapter 7 gives an overview, but chapter 8 gives a little bit more of the detail of this return. And so in verse 1, these are the heads of their father's houses, and this is the genealogy of those who went up with me from Babylon in the reign of King Artaxerxes. Of the sons of Phinehas, Gershom. The sons of Ithamar, Daniel. The sons of David, Hattush. Now there's one, obviously, that's not a Levite. That's from the tribe of Judah right there, because David's from the tribe of Judah. But Phinehas is Levite. That's a son of Aaron. And then verse 3, you've got the sons of Shechaniah and so forth. And this keeps on going down through these list of names through verse 14. And it gives how many males were in each family. Now, you might recall that 2 weeks ago I said to compare this with Ezra chapter 2. There is a similar list given there that was part of Zerubbabel's return. Did anybody do that? Did you notice any similarities between the list in Ezra 2 and Ezra 8? If you take a look at all the names, what you'll find is that there's a lot of the same families represented. And so part of these families came back 80 years prior with Zerubbabel. Part of them were still back in Babylon and the Persian Empire. And so there's been the separation of families for quite some time. And now here they are finishing the return 80 years later with Ezra. So that's all I really wanted you to see out of that, was that there is some similarity between the families listed there in Ezra 2 and Ezra 8. And so about 5,000 people, a good portion of them are priests or have to do with the priesthood. But that's going to come up here in verse 15, which is, at first thought, it may make you scratch your head. So let's take a look at verse 15. Now I gathered them by the river that flows to Ahava, and we camped there 3 days, and I looked among the people and the priest and found none of the sons of Levi there. What's odd about that sentence on first glance? He looked among the people and the priest and found none of the sons of Levi there. Priests are sons of Levi, are they not? That's where the priests come from. That's their tribe. And when you look at all the names there, like I said, you see some Levitical names. Phinehas was the son of Aaron and Gershom and so forth. And if you compare that with genealogies prior, you'll see that this is a lot of priests there. And of course, he mentions the priest, but he says he found none of the sons of Levi there. Is he blind? What is it? Why does he say that? That he doesn't see any Levites. And then what we're going to see is he says, we got to get some Levites here. Okay, well, they had the direct descendants of Aaron. That's the priestly line. Okay, yes, well, it was Levi and then Aaron, and then the direct descendants of Aaron were the high priest. Okay. Okay, good question. Adams asked, is it possible that they weren't pure? They had mixed tribes, and so you don't have any pure Levites. No, I don't think that's the implication, because actually, that was underneath the first return. Remember, there were some that claimed that they were Levites, and they couldn't prove that they were of pure heritage, and so they were excluded. I don't think that's the same situation here. Think about it this way. You've got sons of Levi. Was Aaron the only son of Levi? Not the only son. And of the sons of Aaron, were all the sons high priests? And where did the high priestly lineage go? No, you've got one line down through Aaron and his, and typically the oldest son. Now remember, Nadab and Abihu were killed by God in Leviticus 10. And so he's got two sons left, and then through one of those sons, you're going to have the high priestly lineage. But you've got other Levites. You've got other parts of the Levitical tribe. As I learned growing up, the way to remember this is that all priests are Levites, but not all Levites are priests. Okay? Priests have to be from the tribe of Levi, but not every Levite is a priest. And so you have the priestly lineage, and they had their functions, but remember, the Levites in general, when they were given the inheritance of the land, what did the tribe of Levi receive? Say that again. They were distributed amongst all the tribes. They were given cities and lands around those cities. Why did they not have a specific area? Why were they scattered amongst the nation? Say again. Okay, lead the people in worship. Well, now worship took place in Jerusalem, and of course the priests were part of that. But education, that was one of their main jobs, was teaching the people the law. Say that again. Well, six of those cities that the Levites were given were cities of refuge, yes. I think there were a total of 49, if I recall off the top of my head, a total of 49 cities. Somebody can look that up if you want to, but six of those were the cities of refuge.
Well, they wouldn't have had the lands for the cattle and the herds, because that wasn't what they did. They stayed in the cities.
They did have some land surrounding the cities that they could use for their various herds and so forth, but their main focus was not to be farmers and so forth. Their main focus was with the people, teaching the people, instructing the people, and then they would take turns going to Jerusalem and working there amongst the temple. And now you have the priests that had their specific duties, but then you have other Levites that had other duties with around the temple complex and worship and so forth. And you had some of them that were gatekeepers, some of them that were singers, some of them that were musicians, and all of these various functions that all the Levites performed, depending upon which family you were of. Okay, whichever clan you were of, you had specific duties that were just for your family. And the reason why they were scattered amongst the people was because their job was to teach and to instruct and to help the people spiritually. Okay, and now remember, that's what Ezra's coming back to do. That's his main focus. And so that's why he's bringing the priests with him as part of the worship restoration. But he recognizes that, okay, we've got priests, but we don't have all the other Levites that we need. So let's see what he does about that. Verse 16. Then I sent for Eliezer, Ariel, no, not the little mermaid, Ariel, Shemaiah, Elnathan, Jerib, Elnathan, Nathan, Zechariah, and Meshulam, leaders. Also for Joarib and Elnathan, men of understanding. And I gave them a command for Iddo, the chief man, at the place Casiphia, and I told them what they should say to Iddo and his brethren, the Nethinim, at the place Casiphia, that they should bring us servants for the house of our God. Then by the good hand of our God upon us, they brought us a man of understanding of the sons of Mali, the son of Levi, the son of Israel, namely Sherebiah, with his sons and brothers, 18 men, and Hashabiah, and with him Jeshiah of the sons of Merari, his brothers and their sons, 20 men, also the Nethinim, whom David and the leaders had appointed for the service of the Levites, 220 Nethinim. All of them were designated by name. So they get some wise men, some men of understanding, to go find men who would volunteer on short notice. Hey, everybody else has packed up. They've actually already left. They're camping out on the border here. They've been there for 3 days. Can you please pack up your bags and let's go? And so you have a small handful of people and then 200-something Nethinim that come and are willing to make that trek to Jerusalem. Now, we saw in chapter 7 that the time it takes to get to Jerusalem is about 4 months. 4 months of walking. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 miles, give or take. It's not a direct route. Remember, a direct route is right across desert. And so they have to, as you're looking at it, across desert, they have to go up and over, follow the Fertile Crescent, and follow the rivers, follow the waters. And it's a dangerous journey, and that's referenced here in the next few verses. Questions, comments, though, just about anything we've said so far? Okay. So verse 21. Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God to seek from him the right way for us and our little ones and all our possessions. For I was ashamed to request of the king an escort of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy on the road, because we had spoken to the king, saying, the hand of our God is upon all those for good who seek him, but his power and his wrath are against all those who forsake him. So we fasted and entreated our God for this, and he answered our prayer. So he had been bold to say to King Artaxerxes, God will protect us. And now he's going to God in prayer saying, I've told them that you will protect us. Please do so. And he has confidence that will be the case. And we're going to see, of course, that does happen. Now, verse 24 down to 30 talks about all the gifts that were given to them. Free will offerings by the people, even by the king, all the articles for the temple and so forth, and they're bringing that in for the service of the temple. Take a look at what it says here, verse 24. I separated 12 of the leaders of the priest, Sherebiah, Hashabiah, and 10 of their brethren with them, and weighed out to them the silver, the gold, and the articles, the offering for the house of our God, which the king and his counselors and his princes and all Israel who were present had offered. I weighed into their hands 650 talents of silver, silver articles weighing 100 talents, 100 talents of gold, 20 gold basins worth 1,000 drachmas, and 2 vessels of fine polished bronze, precious as gold. Now, that probably means nothing to all of us today who recognize dollars. Does anybody have a footnote by any chance that gives a rough estimation of how much this all might have been worth? Millions. Yeah, and of course, it's going to vary according to whatever the currency may be doing for the day. But, I mean, we're talking about multi-millions of dollars of valuable things for the temple that were just given to them by the people and by the king. That is. And when you think you got 5,000, approximately 5,000 people bringing this, and they're bringing all their possessions too, and you can see why they would be concerned about the enemy on the road. Can you not? Look at, they can't just wire the money from Babylon to Jerusalem and go into the bank and withdraw it. Now, they're carrying the physical gold and silver and all these utensils and articles for the temple, and it was a perilous journey. You got robbers on the road and bandits and so forth, and so they're entreating God for his favor and for his protection. Continue on, verse 28. I said to them, this is the 12 men that he's entrusting all this wealth to, you are holy to the Lord. The articles are holy also, and the silver and the gold are a freewill offering to the Lord God of your fathers. Watch and keep them until you weigh them before the leaders of the priests and the Levites and heads of the fathers' houses of Israel in Jerusalem in the chambers of the house of the Lord. So the priests and the Levites received the silver and the gold and the articles by weight to bring them to Jerusalem to the house of our God. What's Ezra doing with these 12 men? Especially when he's weighing everything out and dividing it up. What's the implication there?
Everybody knows how much each person has. So make sure it all arrives.
Yeah.
They're in charge of it.
They are the ones responsible for it. They know how much each person has. And so when they get to Jerusalem, what better be the case? Better be the same amount that they started out with. That's right. Yeah. And now, these are of course, people that Ezra trusts, and that's why he's chosen them. But still, he's doing everything above board and showing that they can be trusted. And the next section talks about them arriving in Jerusalem. Verse 31, we departed from the river of Ahava on the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem, and the hand of our God was upon us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambush along the road. So we came to Jerusalem and stayed there 3 days. Now, on the fourth day, the silver and the gold and the articles were weighed in the house of our God by the hand of Merimoth, the son of Uriah the priest, and with him was Eleazar, the son of Phinehas. With them were the Levites, Jozabad, the son of Jeshua, and Noadiah, the son of Binui, with the number and weight of everything. All the weight was written down at that time. So everything they started out with, they had with them, and God had taken care of them along this four-month journey from Babylon to Jerusalem. And they offer up an offering after this, verse 35, the children of those who had been carried away captive, who had come from the captivity, offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, and 12 male goats as a sin offering. All this was a burnt offering to the Lord, and they delivered the king's orders to the king's satraps and the governors in the region beyond the river, so they gave support to the people and the house of God. Okay, so chapter 7 and 8 just detail the return of Ezra and what his mission is going to be, and all the money and the silver, gold, and articles that were donated for this work. Very similar to, of course, what had happened 80 years prior with Zerubbabel, and they had given Zerubbabel and all those people much gold and silver and so forth, and his focus and mission was to build the temple. Ezra is coming in. He's going to beautify the temple, but his main focus is, of course, on teaching the people, the spiritual restoration. Okay. Remember, Ezra and Nehemiah is all about restoration. Did I see your hand up, James? Okay, questions, comments? Yes. Yes.
They're bringing back what belonged there to start with.
At least part of it, yes. Which, you know, the whole process is just amazing that the king is saying, go back home and be your own people, rebuild your nation. I mean, you're not going to have a king. You're not going to be a independent as far as that's concerned, but they're as close, just about as close as you can get. Did I hear somebody over here start to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to ask. In chapter 8, it says they set out on the 12th day of the first
month. Yeah, you caught that, didn't you?
In chapter 7, it says the first day of the first month.
Yeah. Okay, chapter 7 talks about them leaving from Babylon on the first day of the first month. But here in chapter 8, it talks about them leaving on the 12th day. Why the potential discrepancy there?
Is it because they went and camped out?
Yeah, they went and camped for 3 days first. And then they had to send some people back in to the city to say, hey, we need some more people. And then they fasted and prayed and so forth. And all of that process took 12 days, apparently, before they finally continued their journey. But on the first day, they left. They started, but then they camped. And nobody knows where Ahava is, by the way. But it couldn't have been too far away. But they had left the city, and they were on their way when they stopped and camped for 3 days and needed some more help. So that would be the how you would make up the difference there. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Chapters 9 and 10, extremely important to the story. Crucial and critical to Ezra's efforts of a spiritual restoration and so applicable to us today. I think that Ezra 9 and 10 are some of the most important chapters when it comes to similar situations that we find ourselves in today, and the situation is that of marriage and divorce, and what does God think about all this? So, let's take a look at chapter 9. When these things were done, so they've come in, they've delivered all the goods, and who knows exactly how long it's been, but when these things were done, the leaders came to me saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with respect to the abominations of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, so that the holy seed is mixed with the peoples of those lands. Indeed, the hand of the leaders and rulers has been foremost in this trespass. So when I heard this thing, I tore my garment and my robe and plucked out some of the hair of my head and beard and sat down astonished. Then everyone who trembled at the words of the God of Israel assembled to me because of the transgression of those who had been carried away captive, and I sat astonished until the evening sacrifice. What's the big deal, Ezra? So they married some people from other races, other nations, other peoples. What's the big deal? Yeah, very simple. God told them not to. Okay, why did God tell them not to mix, mingle, marry with other nations? Because they were pagans. They were idolatrous people. And what was the warning that God issued through Moses, over and over and over, when they were to come into the land, don't marry them, because of idolatry, but what's going to happen if you do? I'm going to turn them away from Yahweh. You're going to be turned into idolatry, and you're going to start following false gods. Did that happen? Yeah, that's the entire history of Israel, just right there. And that's ultimately what led to the captivity. And now let me ask you this. This is something that we need to make sure that we all understand. Was it inherently wrong, sinful, against the law of Moses to marry somebody from another nation? It's kind of a trick question there. Okay. Okay. Now, we've just established, God said don't marry these people from other nations, but yet we have numerous instances of that happening. Rahab is one. and Ruth is another. The difference is, what did you say? Yeah. These were people that were former pagans. Yeah, they weren't Israelites by birth, but they recognized that, okay, I am now adopting Yahweh as my God, and I am renouncing my pagan background, and I am going to start worshiping and following Yahweh and become, in all essence, a Jew. Okay, not by birth, but by choice. And so it's not that there was a general prohibition against marrying somebody from another country. It's if they're pagans and they're going to remain pagans, then no, you don't. But we have examples of people proselytizing to Judaism, and therefore, I mean, they're okay, and God accepts them. No. Yeah. That's right. Proselytize them first. If they want to join in with us as Jews, great. But what happens when you start going into them and start hanging around them and stuff? Well, there's that temptation, and you're going to get drawn away. And that's why one of the reasons why he said, drive all the people out of the land. As part of it was punishment for their wickedness. But part of it was also for their own preservation, because they knew, or because God knew, that they were going to be a major thorn in the side and a major temptation. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. So that's what drove them into captivity in the first place. And here Ezra comes back, and the priests inform him, some of the people of Israel, priests and the Levites, the leaders come and said that the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites haven't separated themselves. They have married people from all these various lands. And then at the end of verse 2, it says, indeed, the hand of the leaders and rulers has been foremost in this trespass. They're the most grievous offenders. Ezra's got a lot of work to do, doesn't he? Spiritual restoration. Oh, there was a lot of good intentions on this people's part. We've seen that throughout this study in these post-exilic Jews. They wanted to do what's right, but they didn't get everything right. And they still had some things to correct. And here's one of them right here. So he's astonished. He tears his robe and he pulls out some hair. You know, we only talk about that metaphorically. We don't ever really do that today. At least I don't. And I know some people don't have much hair to pull out. Do what? Yeah, if my kids marry pagans, I might be pulling out my hair. That's right. So he sits astonished until the evening sacrifice, and the people gather around with him. And I tell you what, this prayer of Ezra here in chapter 9 is an amazing prayer. There are three prayers in the Old Testament that are really long, really good, a lot to digest, good examples. One is in Ezra 9, another one's in Daniel 9, and I can't ever remember that third one. It's the prayer of Solomon and the dedication of the temple. I can't remember where it's located now, but Ezra 9 is one of these that is pretty amazing. So let's read it, verse 5. At the evening sacrifice, I arose from my fasting, and having torn my garment and my robe, I fell on my knees and spread out my hands to the Lord my God. So he is prostrate before God. And I said, oh my God, I am too ashamed and humiliated to lift up my face to you, my God, for our iniquities have risen higher than our heads, and our guilt has grown up to the heavens. Since the days of our fathers to this day, we have been very guilty. And for our iniquities, we, our kings, and our priests have been delivered into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, to plunder, and to humiliation, as it is this day. And now for a little while, grace has been shown from the Lord our God to leave us a remnant to escape and to give us a peg in his holy place, that our God may enlighten our eyes and give us a measure of revival in our bondage. For we were slaves, yet our God did not forsake us in our bondage, but he extended mercy to us in the sight of the kings of Persia to revive us, to repair the house of our God, to rebuild its ruins, and to give us a wall in Judah and Jerusalem. And now, O our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, which you commanded by your servants the prophets, saying, The land which you are entering to possess is an unclean land, with the uncleanness of the peoples of the lands, with their abominations which have filled it from one end to another with their impurity. Now therefore, do not give your daughters as wives for their sons, nor take their daughters to your sons, and never seek their peace or prosperity, that you may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it as an inheritance to your children forever. And after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great guilt, since you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserve and have given us such deliverance as this, should we again break your commandments and join in marriage with the people committing these abominations? Would you not be angry with us until you had consumed us so that there would be no remnant or survivor? O Lord God of Israel, you are righteous, for we are left as a remnant as it is this day. Here we are before you in our guilt, though no one can stand before you because of this. What did you see in that prayer? What struck you? What thoughts did you have while reading that prayer?
Sorrow and repentance on his part.
Sorrow and repentance. That's what the prayer is all about. What else?
Humility.
Yeah, humility. And it started out with just his bodily position, didn't it? Which was symbolic of that humility. I mean, he was on his knees and bowing down to the ground, his hands spread out, prostrate before the Lord, just showing his humility before God. Okay? What else?
Yeah.
Was Ezra guilty of these sins? Had he been personally guilty of marrying a pagan? No, and yet he's including himself in this and saying, and he's just, this is a national prayer, basically. And he's part of it. He's borne the consequences, has he not, of his father's sins, the forefathers, and captivity and so forth. And then here they are committing it again. And what's he certainly going through his mind of, if you did this to us before, if you punished us before because of this, then what? Yeah. I mean, you're pushing it here, aren't you? When you do this again. Okay. What else?
It's just real heavy when you said you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserve.
Yeah. You know, they received a very real, physical, tangible punishment. And it was a horrible, horrible punishment. And yet, Ezra says, we deserve more than that. There's a realization on Ezra's part here that I think we need to have as well. He recognizes just how bad the sin is that they've committed. He recognizes that they do not deserve mercy, and yet God has given it to them and saved a remnant. Okay, and here's a danger that I know exists with me, and I'm going to assume it exists with some of you as well, maybe even all of you. And that is to take sin so lightly sometimes to where we think that's not a big deal. And do you get that picture from Ezra? No, this is a serious offense. And we can learn that, yeah, we deserve so much more than what we get. We deserve justice, don't we? But what do we get in return through Jesus Christ? We don't get justice, we get mercy, don't we? We don't get what we deserve. And I don't want to get what I deserve. So he realizes that what they got, they actually got off pretty good, considering. God has spared them. He's brought a remnant back. And you cannot just toy with that forgiveness of God. You cannot just take advantage of it and just think, well, we can do this again. Now, it may have been complete ignorance on their part because they were not as familiar with the law as they should have been. It may have been just apathy towards God's law. We don't really know the motives and what was going on with these people, but they hadn't been as diligent as they needed to be. And so Ezra is quite distraught over this. Okay, what else? Any other observations from Ezra's prayer? He mentioned some of the same things that we mentioned before we read it, and that is that this was the very reason that they left or that they got sent away into captivity in the first place, and that it just doesn't treat God right when you do it again in breaking these commandments again. And so he is, in essence, begging God to be merciful yet once more. And no one can stand before them. We do need to tremble, do we not? This is the connection with, makes a connection with what I was saying about the way we view sin. Numerous times in the scriptures, there is the command to fear God. How is that sometimes explained? What does that mean, to fear God? There's usually two explanations. Respect. Okay. Is that true? Does it include respect? Yeah, it does. But brethren, we water it down when we say that fear of God just means to respect Him. Oh, it includes it. But there is a very real sense in which we need to tremble before our God and be very afraid of who He is. Now, I know we have to balance that. The Bible balances it. God balances the message with this message of fear me with a message of look at all the things I'm doing for you. I love you and I want you to love me. It's not all fire and brimstone and I'm going to come down and I'm going to wipe you out and destruction and judgment. No. But parents with kids, don't you want your kids to have a fear of you at times? Don't they need to have that fear of you at times? Love cast out fear. Yeah.
Right. And his whole thing was, how can you do both if it's saying that?
Yeah. That's a great question. And do you want to expand on that, or are you just offering that up to me? Okay. Okay. Clint? Well, Clint's going to offer.
Fear goes into respect. Mm-hmm. You respect from first you fear.
Sure.
Then comes the respect part. I mean, I fear policemen a little bit in the sense that they can give me a ticket or whatever if I do wrong. But I respect them because of
their authority. Exactly. I'm absolutely right. When John says in 1 John 3 or 4 about perfect love cast out fear, I think he is talking about that more mature appreciation and relationship that we can have with our God. And when we love God and we are following Him and we're wanting to do so, not because He is holding it over us as a taskmaster or anything, but because we have come to know who He is, we've come to know who we are in relationship to Him, we see our inadequacies, we see how we've transgressed, we want to do what we can to now please Him and live for Him instead of living for ourselves, then we start following Him and obeying His commandments, and that love is there. Do we have anything to fear at that point as far as judgment is concerned? No, not if we are following in the light and walking in the light as He is in the light. We don't have that kind of fear. Now, Hebrews 10 talks, the Hebrew writer talks about you know, if you just trample underfoot the Son of God and the blood of the covenant, you can't count that as a common thing, then you better be afraid. And it is a fearful thing, he says, to fall into the hands of the living God. But when you're in a family relationship with God, when there is that love, then there is that fear doesn't exist anymore as far as, oh, you know, I'm walking on eggshells here. If I do this, you know, if I make a mistake over here, he's going to zap me. No, that's not what it's about. Okay. But even somebody like Ezra, who would obviously be in a right relationship with Yahweh and a leader, spiritual leader of the people, he recognized that you don't just toy with God's grace and mercy. And you have every right to be afraid of what God will do if we're not following his commandments. And so, I mean, we just like we have to be, we ought to be afraid of policemen. If we're breaking the law, well, they're going to come after us. All right. Questions, comments about any of that? Okay. I knew it was ambitious to try to get through chapter 10, so we will do so next Wednesday. Chapter 10 is the resolution to chapter 9. Chapter 9 is the problem. We got a bunch of people, including the leaders and the priests, that have married pagans. What do we do about it? Chapter 10 gives us the solution to that. And what I would like to focus on as we discuss this and talk about it in applications is how this relates to the concept of repentance. Okay? All right. Thank you, guests.